Hi, everyone. Welcome to Febrile, a culture podcast about all things infectious disease. We use consult questions to dive into ID clinical reasoning, diagnostics, and antimicrobial management. I'm Sarah Dong, your host and a MedPeds ID doc. We are back today with a star episode, State of the Art Review. These focus on recent state of the art reviews that were published in Clinical Infectious Diseases, or CID. So I will start by introducing our guest stars today, who are all joining us from the Division of Public Health, Infectious Diseases, and Occupational Medicine at Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota.
Hi, I'm Hossam Tabaja. I'm really happy to be back on the podcast with you. I'm really thankful for you having me here again.
Dr. Hossam Tabaja is an assistant professor of medicine. His clinical research is focused on hardware-associated infections, including both cardiovascular device infection and orthopedic device infection.
Hi, this is Max Chestachai. Really happy to be here, and thank you so much for having me.
Dr. Supavit Chestachai, or Mac, he is also an assistant professor of medicine. His clinical and research interests include cardiovascular infections and infections in solid organ transplant recipients.
Hi, I'm Dan DeSimone. Thank you so much for having me back. I love Febrile Star. Thank you so much.
And we have Dr. Daniel DeSimone, or Dan. He is a consultant and now professor of medicine at Mayo Clinic. He also holds a joint appointment in the Department of Cardiovascular Diseases. He has chaired and vice-chaired several American Heart Association scientific statements in cardiovascular infectious diseases. His clinical and research interests focus on the prevention, diagnosis, and management of infective endocarditis, cardiac implantable electronic device infections, and vascular graft infections. All right, let's jump in. Well, Febrile is everyone's favorite cultured podcast. I know you guys have shared a little piece of culture before, but I'm going to ask you to share something new today. So what have you guys been interested in recently?
I'll go first. So what I've really been getting into, particularly with the past couple of months where it's about minus 20 out and can't go out on my grill or do any smoking on the grill, I've gotten into sous vide. Is anyone familiar with that?
I have one.
It's pretty cool. It's you're essentially cooking, you know, steak or you name it in nice hot water, and it's cooking it to the perfect temperature you want, and then do whatever you want to do after that. But yeah, I've been getting into that a lot now that the weather's starting to turn around. I'm breaking the grill out more, but I'll tell you what, that sous vide is pretty cool. Highly recommend it for anybody who if you can't cook, it's a good way to not mess things up, and if you can cook, you can tailor things around pretty nice. So yeah, I've gotten into that. Be careful, because once you get into it, you just start to go down a rabbit hole. But it's fun.
Yeah, it is really fun. Makes you feel very professional when you use it.
Oh yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I start speaking French. No, I'm just kidding.
I have to ask sous vide trip from Dan, because I did it in the past, and sometimes the plastic bag is just like ballooning and it just float up. So
yeah, you got to get a good sealer, sometimes double seal. There's a small learning curve. But once you do it, it's worth it.
Yeah. So for me, I don't have any new activity apart from the pickleball that we discussed last time with Hossam. But lately I was very interested in how time different travel and jet lag work, because we just came back from a trip to Thailand, and then that's the first time that my 20 months old daughter flew trans-Pacific, and then we were so concerned about like the time difference, 13-hour time difference, but it turned out to be she was fine in one day. But the problem is that her parents is doing so badly in like 5 days, not recover at all. So I'm really surprised that, you know, when you talk about 13-hour difference in jet lag, it doesn't apply to 20-month-old daughter.
And I feel like that must have been your daughter that I saw at ID Week.
Yes,
right?
You did.
Yeah, very cute.
So I'll go. Yeah, I haven't also been engaging in a lot of new activities, but I have been very busy because I'm actually a new father now. So I have twins, and I think there's a lot of culture around that to be said. Surely a lot of family visits that I was not expecting, and a lot of gifts, which I'm very happy with. a lot of gifts and a lot of things to learn, really. So I've just been busy trying to figure out how to become a father to new twins.
Oh, congrats. I'm sure you have your hands full. Well, I'm very glad to welcome you guys back. I'll just plug that you were here on Febrile back for a state of the art review on vascular graft infections, which I'll put a link to. Hopefully people have listened to that. But this is a different article that focused on the complexities of cardiac device infections. And I think all of these questions that we know sound simple, but actually are quite complex. Like, is the device infected? Should it be taken out? When it is taken out, when is it safe to put it back in? And so we will walk through a case today, but I just want to start more generally and would love to hear about how you think about the way these infections should be handled, or maybe your experience handling them at your institution.
Yeah, Sarah, that's great. Thank you so much for having us. You know, these, as you mentioned, these are not always so straightforward to make the diagnosis of the device being infected. And I think that's probably the big issue here is, or at least the common goal that we share is, we want to keep devices that are not infected in the patient's body. And when they are infected, we want to take them out. And that's very much more easier said than done. In some cases, it's readily apparent it's infected. And in a lot of other cases where it becomes very challenging, it's difficult to make that diagnosis. And hopefully through this podcast, we'll be able to provide our listeners with a good strategy on how to approach these patients and hopefully make it a little bit easier to achieve that goal. When a patient gets admitted to our institution with concern for a device infection, this is not a one-person show. It's going to be multiple teams involved. They may be admitted to, let's say, our hospital medicine service. So that involves our hospitalists as the main care team, and will often require consultation with infectious disease, as well as our heart rhythm or electrophysiology team as well to be involved. That's just a couple elements of the team. Then you have to factor in the possible need for echocardiography. So that brings in our echocardiographers, possibly PET imaging, indium scans, and so on. So radiology, nuclear radiology as well. And that's just part of the team and beyond. So if you do think it's infected, you may have to get general surgery on board for device removal and involved in pocket management after the device is removed, possibly even plastic surgery, depending on the situation and the location, as well as cardiovascular or thoracic surgery to be on standby as backup, as taking the device out is not without risk of significant bleeding, major bleeding, and possibly death. So having cardiovascular surgery or thoracic surgery on standby for backup support following device removal for any complications is critical. So that's kind of start to somewhat finish. And there's even more to that is, okay, a device comes out. Does a new device need to go back in? And that's where our cardiologists and heart rhythm specialists come into play. So that's kind of the approach. And again, there's some things that go on in between. Are they bacteremic or not? Is there something on the echo, on the heart valve, or the lead itself, or both? And then do they need a new device put back in? And when do you put that back in? So with that, I'll turn things over to Mac and Hussam to go further into those scenarios.
Excellent. All right. Well, I'm going to introduce our patient that we're going to be taking care of in the hospital. We meet a 65-year-old woman with morbid obesity, diabetes, and a cardiac device who presented to clinic with 3 days of pain, redness, and swelling at the generator pocket site. So we're going to pause right here this early and ask about how should we start our assessment?
Yeah. As Dan mentioned, CID infection is a very complex syndrome that require the whole village or multiple people help taking care of this. And the definition of the CID infection itself has changed multiple times since the first statement came out in 2003. And then the most recent one that Dan is a lead author came out in 2023 to 2024, provide a variety of the definition of the CID infection. But in general, when we talk about a CID infection, we need to think about two main things. The first one is that the pocket part, and then the second one is the infection of the lead or valve. So when we talk about the infection of the lead and valve, we call that CID-related endocarditis. the pocket itself can happen with or without endocarditis. So that's the reason why any part of the device is infected, the whole system become infected. That's the reason how we define the infection. So the most challenging thing is that how to diagnose the CIED-related infective endocarditis. Because with the pocket generator site infection, you can get that from the physical exam in most of the case, which is if we ask what is the most common presentation of CIED infection, it's mainly the pocket generator site, which has happened in 2/3 of the cases. So 1/3 of the cases will have the device endocarditis as well. But we can talk more of why it is so challenging to diagnose whether the patient has device-related infective endocarditis or not.
So we learned a little bit more. This patient had their device implanted 8 years earlier for a history of sudden cardiac death with a recent generator revision 2 months ago. She also had fatigue, fever, and chills. And our physical exam shows erythema, tenderness, and fluctuation at the generator pocket site. There isn't any purulent drainage, sinus tract formation, or device exposure noted. So what is our best next step?
Yes. So basically, if I summarize this question, you're basically I'm being asked to see a patient who's presenting with pocket site inflammation. Let's call it inflammation. And so my job here is to figure out whether or not this inflammation is related to infection or not infectious, right? Because this soon after a revision, only 2 months out, there are other non-infectious causes of pocket site inflammation, such as allergic reaction to the component or maybe a hematoma. There are certain tools that we could use to help us make that decision. And the first tools are history and physical exam, which is just similar to what we use with any syndrome that we encounter. Right? So there are certain things in history that are important to tease out. For example, in order to assess the risk of infection, you have to look at the age of the patient. You need to look at the complexity of the device. Is this a multiple lead? Is this a pacemaker, a CRTD? You need to know whether or not this is the first device. Is this a revision? How many times has it been revised before? What are the comorbidities? Are there other cardiovascular devices? So all of this helps you define the host, and then you'll get an understanding of what is the risk of infection. The next thing is you want to look for signs and symptoms that will give you a definite diagnosis of CIED infection, because based on history and physical exam, there are certain signs that can actually confirm that you have an infection without having to do any additional testing. And those are not frequent. There's not too much of those. There's maybe 3 to 4 signs. And some of those, you know, include pus coming out from the pocket, sinus tract, device exposure, which this patient does not have. So if this patient had those signs, then just by history and physical exam, I will be able to tell there is a CIED infection. And the next step will be to do a blood culture, because you want to know whether or not the patient is bacteremic, not to make the diagnosis. The diagnosis is already made. The blood cultures help you because if they're positive, they're going to determine your next step in management. Okay. But this patient does not fall in this category. She's presenting with signs of inflammation, but there is no signs or symptoms that are definite for CIED infection. So then the question is, what other tools can we use? And really, this soon after revision, in my mind, the only thing that we would do is a blood culture for this patient, because I won't rely on CRP, ESR, white blood cell count this soon after the revision, because they're not going to be specific for CIED infection. I also don't rely so much on imaging like ultrasound, CT scans, or PET CT this early after revision, because I would expect to see something and it will still not tell me whether or not this is an infected abscess, for example, or a hematoma. So in my mind, for those patients, the only thing that you could rely on really is a blood culture at this point, because if the blood culture is positive, then that also will upgrade this patient from an uncertain category to a confirmed or a definite CIED infection. Whenever you have a local pocket inflammation and you have a positive blood culture, that by definition is CIED infection. And so then we would manage it accordingly. The more difficult situation is if there is negative blood culture, because then you're stuck again with this challenging question. How do I prove that this patient has a CIED infection? And it becomes more challenging if there is no systemic symptoms. You know, this patient actually has systemic symptoms, so maybe it's a bit easier. But if someone comes in with mild inflammation, maybe just minimal swelling, no systemic symptoms. This could just be a hematoma, an inflammatory reaction from allergic reaction. It could be even a superficial cellulitis. So this is where it becomes controversial. Some physicians in those situations would put patients on oral antibiotics empirically, considering this may be a superficial cellulitis, and then they will just follow very closely to see how they respond. Other physicians would not put antibiotics, and they will just follow them clinically and see how things change, because, you know, give it some time and let it declare itself, basically. But I would say these situations are the less straightforward situations.
I think it might be helpful to comment on pocket infection and not aspirating the pocket, because I think maybe for residents and earlier trainees that might not seem intuitive when we're usually asking for a sample. Would you be willing to just say a couple sentences on that?
So, you know, there is some physicians that might consider doing an ultrasound-guided aspiration. If there's a fluid pocket, send that to for culture, see if it looks like pus or not. In our center, we really don't like to do that. We try to avoid that as much as possible. And the main reason is because, you know, if you're not able to confirm the diagnosis of CID infection based on blood cultures and physical exam, we worry that if it's not infected, we're going to now introduce an infection into the pocket. So we don't really like to do that much. And I personally have never seen it being done. I don't know if Dan or Mac has seen that done before. I have seen it done in other devices. So we do have a lot of deeper brain stimulator devices, for example, here, which they have generative pockets. And a lot of times the surgeons here would do an aspiration of the fluid. But I have not seen a cardiovascular disease physician or an infectious disease physician here in this center in Mayo Clinic that would do an ultrasound guided aspiration of the pocket, just because we worry that we might now introduce an infection and it leads to bacteremia and endocarditis.
Yeah, I agree with Hassan that I never done it. But Dan can also add on to that too, that I think there was a study from Israel that they put like a catheter directly into the pocket and try to infuse the antibiotics into the pocket in the setting of pocket infection. But I don't think that has been widely used, and that is only in the investigational study rather than clinical practice.
Yeah, so Mac, in that study where they put a catheter in, they're instilling antibiotics as a way to treat an infection rather than to make the diagnosis. But from a diagnostic standpoint, typically why we would advise against doing an aspiration of the pocket would be, what if there is no infection? You may have potentially introduced infection now. So every time you go into that pocket, you run the risk of leading to infection of that device. So in this patient's history, in our example here, they had a revision 2 months ago. So that's a big red flag that they went back into that pocket and now is showing up with some pocket findings and systemic symptoms that your suspicion for infection really has to go up here. Now, I've seen where you can get an ultrasound of the pocket, and sometimes you could say, hey, this might look like an abscess that might tilt you more towards this being infected. But putting a needle and entering that pocket is very uncommon to do and typically advise against that.
Thanks, guys. All right. The team has grabbed two sets of blood cultures. These were drawn before vancomycin was administered. And in these cultures, we have gram-positive cocci resembling streptococci that grew after about 14 hours. So what would be our approach now?
Yeah, so this gets interesting now. So given this patient's history, now findings of positive blood cultures, I think doing the right thing is starting the vancomycin. You know, this could either be a streptococcus or an enterococcus. So I think starting the antibiotic at this point, it would recommend that and encourage that. But I think the big thing here is the organism is very important when you approach cardiac device infections. This is your pretest probability of when you get that echocardiogram in a patient who has a positive blood culture is going to be critical. So in somebody like this with their history, with an organism that's growing either strep or enterococcus, now my suspicion is very high that this device is infected. And the recommendation would be to take it out. Now, there's more discussion there, and we'll likely talk about this later when it comes time to make that decision to take things out. But I think Your next best step here is, does this patient have valvular or lead endocarditis? And really the focus is on valvular endocarditis, as that has downstream ramifications if the valve has a vegetation. So if there's valvular endocarditis, your duration of therapy is going to be longer. So you're not going to treat this as just a standard bloodstream infection or bacteremia with, say, 2 weeks of antibiotics, you're likely going to go down the route of 4 to 6 weeks. So you can see how that changes your therapy there, as well as it'll have implications on reimplantation if the patient needs it, on timing of reimplantation. So instead of 72 hours, you may wait up to 2 weeks to put a new device back in if it's needed. That's the next step in this patient's route here of getting an echocardiogram. A TTE and TEE would be recommended. And again, you're looking for valvular endocarditis as well as any potential vegetations on the lead. Now, that's again, going to direct us to our next step.
That's perfect. And you guys, for those who have the paper, that figure two roadmap is about where we're talking about. And Hussam started talking earlier about the importance of knowing if someone has a bloodstream infection or not. And I think one way we can also reframe this patient is, how would we think about them differently if they had come in and we identified a bloodstream infection, but there's no signs of generator pocket site infection? How do you reason through what to do for those patients?
Yeah, and I think this is a very important question, because we run into this situation all the time when the patient got hospitalized with bacteremia and then they have pacemaker or ICD in place. Sometimes we don't know what to do about them. Should we do echocardiogram? Should we not? Should we just monitor? So it's very, very important question, and not a lot of study looking into this scenario. So as you mentioned, it is very clear if the patient walked to you and have the pus come out of the pocket, we know that device need to come out no matter what. But when the patient come in with bacteremia, it's just very difficult to know whether the device is infected or not. I think the main principle that we would work on is the same as the patient with vascular graft and other device. So it's very depend on the pathogen specific. For example, if the patient has a Staph aureus bacteremia, you would be very confident that you need to look into the device itself. However, if the patient has like very localized symptom of, for example, UTI and have a gram-negative bacteremia, the chance that the E. coli or other gram-negative would see the device is very low. So all of those situations, you do not need to specifically look at the device itself, either with the TE or other modality. We always run into the issue when we encounter the pathogen that we are uncertain. For example, Staph aureus, definitely high risk. Coag negative Staph, definitely high risk. Enterococci, I would also throw into the high risk category as well, the same as Viridan group. But from time to time, when we run into other gram-positive, other streptococci or high-risk gram-negative such as serratia or pseudomonas, from time to time, it's very difficult to tell. So we need to think about other factors as well. For example, does the patient has prolonged bloodstream infection? Are we able to identify the source of bloodstream infection? Does the patient has like cardiac device or other valvular processes valve? The more factor that the patient has, the more we think that the device might be infected. For example, prolonged bacteremia, community onset, and we could not find a source. So that's the time when we need to look closely into the device. And one thing that I also want to mention is that the prior study also came up with a multiple scoring system to see, especially with the Staph aureus in the past. In around 2015, we come up with a score called PREDICT-SAB. So we try to plug in the clinical factor that I just mentioned in how long has the patient have been bacteremic and everything like that, into to see that if the patient has a Staph aureus bacteremia, what is the likelihood of the underlying device is infected. And then the most recent one, the study group from Europe also come out with the score called a CTEP score, which coming from like community acquisition, time to positivity, embolization, risk factor for IE, and persistent bacteremia. So we can use those scores to fit into the clinical context and see how high of a risk of that the patient who come in with bacteremia has to have underlying device infection. For other organisms, we still do not have a good score. We can apply the same score that out there to predict the endocarditis, for example, like Handock score for the streptococci or DeNova score for enterococci, but all of those are not specific to the device itself. But I think it's good enough, plus the clinical judgment to see whether we really need to send the patient to transesophageal echocardiogram or do additional PET CT. So I think it's two main things, depend on the pathogen-specific viral length and then depend on the nature of the bacteremia itself and the host factor.
Great. So for this patient, they underwent TEE, which demonstrated a small echo density at the atrial aspect of the CIED lead. There's no valvular vegetations observed. Here, we can talk about challenges in interpreting TEE findings. And then I think the other question that we've started alluding to is when to use PET CT. And so I'd love to hear about how you decide on when to reach for that modality.
Okay, perfect. To best answer this question, really, figure three in the article that we have actually talks a lot about this. So if we are looking at the patient in our main question, you know, what is the role of the echo here? To me, you know, we've already made the diagnosis of CIED infection for this specific patient just based on physical exam and positive blood culture. So the echo here is not really for diagnostic purposes specifically, because we are already labeling this patient as having CIED infection, and we're going to treat accordingly. The purpose of the echo here is to tell us what is the duration of treatment, and when is it okay to re-implant a device? And this will really depend on whether or not the valve has vegetations, or is there any vegetations only on the lead, or is there no vegetation? So really the echo helps us determine these two questions for this patient. The more challenging situation is if the patient had come in with bloodstream infection and no pocket site infection or no pocket site inflammation. So in those patients, the echo is done for diagnostic purposes. We are trying to get more information to decide whether or not the device is actually infected and if whether or not we should treat it as such. So this is where the role of echo becomes more critical. And when we're thinking about echo findings, I can think of three scenarios, really. The first scenario is you do an echo and you find valve vegetations. So that is actually the most straightforward scenario, because if you do see that, then you're saying this patient has endocarditis, valvular endocarditis, and that in itself equates to device infection. And you're going to have to discuss extracting the device and treating for endocarditis with 6 weeks of antibiotics. The other two scenarios are less straightforward. And those include the second scenario, which is you do an echo and you find a lesion on the lead, but you're not seeing lesions elsewhere. So kind of similar to the echo we're seeing here. The third scenario is you do an echo and you don't see any lesions. Now, none of these two scenarios are either sensitive or specific for device infection, because you could have a lesion on the lead that is a sterile thrombus, and it's actually common to have clots on those leads, especially if those leads have been there for a while. And there is nothing on the echo that can specifically tell you if this clot is infected or if it's sterile. So really, I cannot tell whether or not this lead vegetation or this echo density on the lead is an infected vegetation or it's a thrombus that's sterile. Even the third scenario where you don't see any lesions, I'm still not able to confidently rule out a device lead endocarditis, because you could still miss that on the echo, especially if you can't visualize the entire lead. And so when it comes to these two scenarios, I think your decision has to be based on other factors like the type of pathogen, which Mac has spoken about just now, and also the burden of the bacteremia, community acquired bacteremia, high grade, multiple sets, persistent, no primary focus. If you have this high burden bacteremia and if you have a high risk pathogen like Staph aureus, then in my mind, I would still consider this device likely infected. And a lot of experts actually would go ahead and discuss extracting the device without doing further testing, because in their mind, the pretest probability for a device infection is already very high with things like Staph aureus bacteremia, high burden bacteremia. But when you're talking about other bacteria, like maybe gram negatives, Clostridium, Cutibacterium, other types of bacteria, you cannot make that assumption, because the pretest probability that the device is infected is not that high, not similar to Staph aureus. And that's when you start wondering, is there any other test that I could do to help me make that decision? And that's where PET CT comes in. And you really, if you look at, there are so many different societies now that have strengthened their language and statement about using PET CT for device infection. Ever since 2019 up until now, they've been talking about the use of PET CT for those cases. And we know that PET CT actually has a very decent sensitivity and specificity for device infection. And so a lot of big centers that have PET CTs, they will probably go ahead and get a PET CT for those cases. And if it's positive, they call the device infected. If it's negative, they say the device is probably not infected. But we have to be very careful and cautious because there are cons to the PET CT. The biggest con really is that not every center will have it accessible or readily accessible. So some centers can't just get a PET CT. And the longer you wait and the longer that the patient has been on antibiotics, the less reliable that PET CT becomes, because we think that the antibiotic can decrease the inflammation. And so, you know, if you're not able to get the PET CT very quickly, it might not be such a tempting test to get. The other cons for the PET CT is that while we think and we know it's sensitive and specific, it's mostly for pocket site infections. So it's not that sensitive for lead site infection. And that's why some experts, when they have a high pretest probability for device infection, like with Staph aureus, hybrid, and bacteremia, they would not get a PET CT. They will just discuss extracting the device because they think even if we do a PET CT and it comes back negative, it still does not rule out a lead endocarditis because it's not as sensitive for leads as it is for pocket site infections. So that's actually one very important thing to keep in mind. So to summarize things, the role of PET CT seems to be more tempting when you have an intermediate pretest probability for device infection. Because in those cases, you think that if it's a negative PET CT, then it adds another reassuring layer that the patient probably does not have a device infection. Now, we spoke about the PET CT. What about centers that can't get a PET CT? What is one other approach that they could consider? Again, if they think that their pretest probability for device infection is not that high, one approach would be to actually treat the bacteremia, stop the antibiotics after treatment, and do surveillance blood cultures about 5 to 7 days after you stop the antibiotics. If the bacteremia recurs and you still don't have another source, then it's probably a device infection and then you have to treat it accordingly. And so that's kind of, you know, talking about the echoes and PET CTs and what to do if you can't do a PET CT as well.
Yeah, I just want to add one point is that apart from the accessibility of the PET CT, the cost also another concern, especially when we have a different reimbursement system, whether it's going to cover outpatient, it's going to cover inpatient, or whether it's a cancer or non-cancer indication. But surprisingly, in Europe, they have no issue with this, with the reimbursement. That's the reason why if you look at the European CIED guideline in 2019 and also the updated endocarditis guideline in 2023, They state very clearly that if the patient has a Staph aureus bacteremia with the device in place, they recommend every single patient to get PET CT. Because apart from the device itself, it can also identify those metastatic foci and everything like that. But that also reflects that in Europe, they don't have a lot of problem in reimbursement that we still seeing here in the US.
One other question that I think needs a lot of, you know, thought and more studies to answer that question is the mortality and morbidity benefit of getting those PET CTs, right? Especially like when we're talking about finding out where other sites of seeding, you know, like for example, if you have Staph aureus bacteremia, did it seed somewhere else? Is there a deep abscess? And the PET CT will help you find that out. But there are studies showing that it does not really maybe affect mortality or morbidity that much. So I think that's a very important question also to look more into in future studies. If I get a PET CT for those cases, does it really change the overall outcome in terms of morbidity and mortality?
Yeah, thank you guys so much for covering that. It's a big topic and obviously a conversation point on many consults. Well, despite some of her comorbid conditions, the cardiology team does recommend complete CIED extraction for this patient. The patient and her family have expressed some reluctance due to concerns about the complications. And so how do you structure your discussion when you're in this type of scenario?
Yeah, it's a great question. And that comes up in every case. right? It's a procedure that carries significant risks and potential bad outcomes. Granted, it's low for it to happen. It's quoted anywhere between 1% to 2%, depending on the center and their experience and expertise available. And they can be very serious complications that include bleeding to the superior vena cava. You can get a tear, you can get cardiac tamponade, among other things. And death is a potential risk. So those are real complications from device removal. So that's why we want to be as certain as possible that the device is infected, taking it out, which again, as we've been talking about, it's not always as straightforward. But you have to balance that with, well, what if we just keep the device in and put the patient on antibiotics? How well does that work? There's been very limited data out there looking at long-term suppression with chronic antibiotic use. Actually, only one study I can think of that looked at that. And the data from there showed that it's an option, but it should be one of your final options of suppression. And every effort should be made to remove the device. And the reason for that is there's risk of relapse with device retention, especially if there's valvular or CID-related infective endocarditis. Keeping a device in is associated with high mortality as well as high rates of relapse. So again, you're in this balancing act of, well, if we keep the device in, there's risk the infection can come back, or potentially we may not be able to control the infection, versus while there's real risk to the procedure, as I mentioned. Ways to approach the patient is making them aware of these potential risks and complications from going for device removal, but also the risk of not going for device removal. This is something where you're going to make a shared decision approach with the patient. And other things that are important to consider is these devices should be extracted at centers of excellence where they are doing this on a regular basis. The providers that are removing these devices should have significant experience with this and have a support system backing them up. And what I mean by that is vascular surgery, if there is a tear to the SVC or other major vessels, cardiothoracic surgery on standby, ready to go if there is a complication, as these patients may require opening their chest to repair from these complications. So again, it's a discussion you got to have with each and every patient and come together what you think is best for that patient at that time. There's so many variables that come into play, and listening to the patient and their family and what are their concerns. You know, it may be they're not worried about the 1 in 100 chance. They're more worried about the pain or something else happening, or maybe they have a tough time waking up from sedation. And so really asking the patient and their family, what are their concerns? We have our concerns and what we think is concerns, but it may not always match what the patient is concerned about or their family.
And we left this case a little broad. I was going to ask now about how you guys set your final antibiotic plan and the question of when you can re-implant when a device is removed. We didn't pinpoint a specific bug because I think maybe today our goal is to talk more broadly. But yeah, how would you approach that?
Yeah, so I think that's the question that we all get asked about after the device removed, when is the appropriate time to place it back. I think it's very depend on what kind of syndrome that the patient has. So the principle is that if the patient has the vegetation on the valve, we would prolong the time of re-implantation as long as possible. And most of the time we use 14 days because our hypothetical concern is that if we put the new device too soon and the patient has the vegetation persistently on the valve, we concern that vegetation will become a new foci and eventually infect the new device that we place. So if the patient has the vegetation or the valve, we would want to wait as long as possible, 14 days if possible. If the patient doesn't have vegetation on the valve, just the lead vegetation or no vegetation at all, and then the device got extract, we would wait for 48 to 72 hours after the first negative blood culture. So as long as the patient has clear from the bacteremia perspective, we should be able to put the new device in. some study in Europe also, if the patient doesn't have bacteremia, the sooner that you can place a new device in, actually in the same day. So they put a new device in the contralateral side if the patient doesn't have bacteremia. So I think the key is that as long as the patient is no longer bacteremic, it should be safe to place a new device unless the patient has a vegetation on the valve. So I'm going to touch a little bit about the interim strategy, because that's also an important topic that we need to discuss. Mainly what device is going to be placed is depend on what was the indication that the patient has device in the first place. Maybe the patient no longer need device, which is great. We don't need to have a time or new device implant. But let's say if the patient continue to have indication, for example, ventricular arrhythmia or cardiac pacing that need a new device, so that need to be discussed with the electrophysiologist. Because if, for example, if they do not want to put the intravascular device, maybe we have the alternative. For example, if the patient who need a cardiac pacing without the ICD function, we can use the leadless pacemaker in that situation. But if the patient doesn't need a cardiac pacing but need the ICD function, we can use the subcutaneous or the extravascular ICD in that situation. But from time to time, if the patient need both, we may not be able to find any interim strategy, especially when the patient that we want to prolong the implantation. So that's the reason why I said prolong as much as possible, because when we say 14 days, it's not always possible in the clinical practice. And regarding the antibiotics, you know, after the device extraction, if the patient has a valve vegetation, we would treat the same as infective endocarditis, which is 4 to 6 weeks. But if the patient doesn't have the vegetation on the valve, we can do shorter than that, which is 2 to 4 weeks.
Great. And after some discussion of risks and benefits, the patient and family declined the device extraction. At this point, the patient's been on vancomycin. Blood cultures have cleared. So what would be your strategy here and planning for follow-up once they're in the outpatient setting?
As long as the device remains, unfortunately, there is no objective test that we could do after treatment. So let's say we're going to treat this syndrome for 4 to 6 weeks with antibiotics. After we finish this treatment, there is no objective test that will tell us the infection is completely eradicated from the device. And so to simplify things, those cases would require to be on antimicrobial suppression after you finish the treatment phase. Of course, it's not as simple as I'm making it sound, because we're in the era of antimicrobial resistance. A lot of times we might not have good or tolerable oral options to suppress these patients after the treatment. We don't know how long to suppress them for. We don't have very good longitudinal studies to tell us or answer this question. Dan had talked about one study which had 48 patients where they suppressed. And, you know, in that study, they had about 18% relapse. So we also don't have much studies to tell us about relapse, how long to keep the patient antibiotic, what happens when we stop the antibiotics, how much of those patients tolerate the antibiotics and things like that. So it is really not an easy thing to manage, I would say. As long as the device is retained, you want to try to keep this patient on antimicrobial suppression as much as possible. And so, you know, in my mind, what I would do is I would finish the treatment course, again, 4 to 6 weeks, depending on the syndrome, see the patient at that point, make sure that the pocket looks good, make sure that the patient looks good, and then have a discussion with the patient about getting them on an oral antibiotic that will potentially help suppress their infection as long as possible and as long as they tolerate it. But usually it's not an easy discussion, especially when you're trying to tell the patient that you're likely going to need to be on antibiotics for the rest of your life. And so a lot of patients, they might not be very excited about that. So it's very important to mention this plan even early on during their treatment. Don't wait until they're done with their treatment and say, hey, we're going to put you on oral antibiotics now to suppress you indefinitely. I think this is something that you have to discuss during the shared decision making, which Dan talked about. And this should be early during the hospitalization course itself.
So you guys covered quite a big topic in a pretty short amount of time. To end, I was just going to ask you, separate from this case, what things you're most excited about in this subset of ID cardiac device infections? What things are you most interested in learning about? Maybe studies that are underway that you're looking forward to hearing results on?
I think we all can share this answer. For me, is that I want to see more accurate diagnosis in this field, because as Hassan mentioned, even though we have TE, we have PET-CT, but we still in a lot of conundrum whether this device is infected or not, whether we should extract it or not, because everything that we offer to the patient is impact their life substantially. For example, if we say that, hey, we are unsure, but we should remove your device, it's not just easy, as we say, because that would involve multiple people. So that's why I'm excited to see whether is there any new tools, any new modality that coming out. And regarding the treatment perspective, we don't have a lot of things in the pipeline right now, but I would like to see if is there any way that we can treat the device infection without a chronic suppression, or chronic suppression in a very limited time, not lifelong. That's the thing that I'm excited for.
Yeah, especially with like using biofilm active agents in those treatments, is there any role for rifampin? Does quinolone have a different efficacy than other antibiotics? Because we know that it has biofilm activity. So, you know, what is the role of adding those types of agents to the treatment? And does it really help us get the patient off suppression if we retain the device? So that's one thing I would like to look at. It will be really nice if there is something that could be done about the device itself to make it more resistant to infections in the first place. And I know there has been other things that have been looked at in the past, like this antibiotic envelope. Dan, you spoke to us multiple times about this in the past. And so, you know, what are advances that are happening in the field to somehow make this device resistant to getting those bacteria seeding on it?
Yeah, I think that's definitely the future. We're seeing some of it already with leadless pacemakers. I think that's really the future for this. I mean, we are putting leadless pacemakers in patients, you know, over the last several years. The issue is you can't do a leadless in everybody based on, you know, does it need atrial sensing? And certain people rely on that. It gets beyond the infectious disease doc in me. It goes more towards the electrophysiologist to comment on that. But I know they're working on developing those leadless pacemakers to kind of be the go-to for patients. It's very easy to take out as compared to a device that has been in the chest pocket for 10 years. So there's benefits there. The material itself is different compared to the current CIEDs, like pacemaker ICDs. So these organisms like the staphylococci, like that, what they have on their surface and what they like to stick to, it's less likely to be sticky to the leadless pacemakers. So it doesn't mean leadless pacemakers don't get infected. They do, just much less likely. Plus the size and surface area. So if you have like a big bulky CRT with three leads, compare that to something that's maybe the size of a little bigger than a reasonable size pill of Augmentin, you know, there's only so much surface area for that organism to attach compared to multiple leads and a big pocket generator. And you think of your patients, a lot of these patients are going to be elderly, frail. There's only so much skin, soft tissue to that pocket. This is endovascular. So I think that is definitely the future, is going leadless. There's also subcutaneous, where you can go outside of the bloodstream and go sub-Q and tunnel these leads and have external leads rather than be in the bloodstream. And I think that's a big factor here. So I know Husami mentioned about deep brain stimulators, you know, and again, that and their management is a little bit different than complete device extraction. Sometimes it's just taking out the generator and they'll leave the leads in, or there's a lot of ways to go about it, but it's different. And sometimes suppression works really well. It's these devices that are intravascular, they're in the bloodstream. Those are tough to suppress compared to, say, like a prosthetic joint or deep brain stimulator, where it's just not in that, it's not endovascular in that bloodstream. So I'm excited for the future in that regard. And then probably PET imaging, but rather than using FDG, looking at more like organism specific, to where, hey, I know there's Staph aureus in the blood, let's do a Staph aureus specific biomarker tracer that we can search for. Maybe that'll give us better uptake than just FDG avidity, because those device leads are only going to have so much surface area. They're only going to have so much uptake. And as you get further away from the pocket, that sensitivity of PET goes down. So I think that's my big thing is our available tools to make the diagnosis of device infections, echo and PET scan, are not great. So I said a lot there, but I'm excited for the future. And I think leadless is the way to go.
This paper, we collaborate with multiple subspecialty, cardiology, electrophysiology, nuclear medicine expert and also CV surgery. So the co-author who wrote the paper also reflects like the real life that when we manage a CID infection, as Dan mentioned earlier, we need the whole village. We need to talk to patient, we need to talk to family, and we need to talk to multiple people in order to make a decision for one patient.
Thank you so much to Assam, Mac, and Dan for joining Febrile today. You can find their article, State of the Art Review, Complexities in Cardiac Implantable Electronic Device Infections, a Contemporary Practical Approach in Clinical Infectious Diseases. This is linked on the webpage as well as in the episode information. You can check out their prior STAR episode on vascular graft infections, episode number 110. If you're looking to hear another episode related to cardiac device infection diagnosis and management, you can check out episode number 78, featuring some of our both ID and cardiology colleagues. Don't forget to check out the website, febrilepodcast.com, to find the console notes, which are written supplements to the episodes with links to references, our library of ID infographics, and a link to our merch store. Febrile is produced with support from the Infectious Diseases Society of America, IDSA. Please reach out if you have any suggestions for future shows or want to be more involved with Febrile. Thanks for listening. Stay safe, and I'll see you next time.